Listeners and Patreon subscribers to the 9-8 podcast, the home of everything progressive and underground right here in Australia. My name is Alex Hogg. Every fortnight, well, I would say fortnight, but it's been a while, I'm joined by Mr. Dave Ellis. Hello, Dave.
Good morning. How are you, my friend?
I'm all right. I suppose we should probably start off by addressing the slightly smaller elephant in the room. There's a larger one we'll get to later. As my grandfather always told me, when there's an elephant in the room, introduce it. Mm-hmm. It's been quite some time since we've actually done a show.
It has. It's been a while. We actually were going to record a couple of weeks ago, but Hoggy was at undisclosed location in WA. And unfortunately, it just made it impossible to do.
We were beset by technical problems.
You know, it's been just a bit of a clusterfuck. Yeah. So this is the first opportunity we've had to record. But the good news is that we are recording the week that we are actually releasing. So this is a very fresh episode. Hopefully, there's going to be nothing major that happens in the time that we release this in 2 days' time.
Now you've said that.
Yeah, touch
wood. Tomorrow we're going to have to sit down again and do something else. Anyway, we do have a piece of follow-up here, and this comes from, well, not necessarily from, but it's about self-caring. They've released a book to go with their rather excellent record that came out last year, Mount Pleasant. So the concept book consists of 10 short stories based on songs on the record. So we'll put a link in the show notes to, if that sounds like something you're interested in, a link in the show notes where you can go and buy that.
Absolutely. That does sound something like I would be interested in, actually. I might have to go and check that one out. And I do want to throw an additional piece of follow-up in here as well. For those of you that remember, I'm in a play coming up in here in Sydney. It's a musical. Yes, that means I'm singing. And yes, that means you get to throw tomatoes at me. Please don't. Tickets are selling for that.
Dave, you don't say tomatoes. If you want people to throw something at you, obviously it's jelly beans.
Yes, or money. Money, I will settle for some $2 coins despite how much they hurt. If you do want to come along to that, we'll put a link to the tickets for that in the show notes below. And also, just very quickly, we are going to be having a couple of the cast on the show. The music director and the actual one of the authors of the play as well is going to come and join us on the show, so you can hear a little bit more about that probably next time. That's called Bakery Hill. Check it out. That's my follow-up done. Is your follow-up done?
Yes, it is. So that about wraps it up for follow-up, so we'll jump into the news. And, well, our news segment today basically falls into one of three categories. We've got what's touring going to look like in 2021, what's touring going to look like in Brexit, and then new music. So we'll tackle the biggest and ugliest one first, is the touring in 2021. Now, I figured that we could probably do this segment every week and talk about all the tours that have been postponed and cancelled and rah-rah. And I could probably hang a tagline underneath this of, like, touring in 2021, and it all hangs on the vaccine rollout.
Absolutely.
It does, because it's been mentioned so many times. People say, oh, what's happening? We've finally had some semi-official confirmation of a planned King Crimson tour here in Australia at the end of this year. And the band are basically saying, well, yeah, it all hangs on the vaccine rollout and whether or not we're allowed to tour. They've got unique problems as well, in that one half of the band is based in the UK and the other half of the band is based in America. So you've got multiple countries trying to deal with their vaccine rollout problems.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the clusterfuck that's the United States as well.
Well, you say that because I saw something that my wife sent me something about how the vaccine rollout is going in the EU. And they're saying at current projections, it was going to take most of this year to get 70% of the adults in the UK vaccinated. It's going to take about 3 years for the same number, for the same percentage of people in Germany to get done. It's going to take about 10 years to get the same number of people in Italy done. Mm. And it's going to take about 20 years to get the same number of people in Bulgaria done.
Mm-hmm.
So that gives you a fair idea of, okay, Germany's got like 80, 90 odd million people to try and vaccinate. So that's a lot of people to try and get done. But that gives you some idea of like, and then you've got Bulgaria, which has got like 5 million people to get done. That's just going to be a complete mess trying to get that done.
Oh, absolutely.
Because bureaucratically, the country's a nightmare. But that gives you, and you know, here in Australia, we haven't even started yet, which is bananas. But anyway.
Well, I mean, yes, but don't forget that we've got the we're the front of the queue, Hoggy. We are definitely at the front of the queue behind 110 other countries.
Behind literally every other continent that has already started vaccinating people.
Yeah, anyway. Exactly. Yeah, but we're at the front of the queue. It's okay.
Yeah, of course.
This could almost be a bloody Clarkson Door skit, couldn't it? We're at the front of the queue, but which queue? Well, not the express queue. No, not the express queue. It's the other queue. Is it the last queue? Yes, it's the queue that's going to go last. And how many people are in that? One. Is that just us?
Yeah,
yes,
exactly.
But we're at the front of the queue. You know what I mean? Like, it could totally be one of those things.
Yeah, totally. It does sound a bit sort of Python-esque.
It does.
Yeah. So anyway, that's the and so based upon that, Bird's Robe Collective have sort of made we'll put an article in the show, a link to an article that they've written in the show notes about what's going to happen on a local scale here in Australia. And again, it's sort of like, well, who knows? I mean, now you're going to have to fill me here in this as we're recording this podcast right now. Western Australia has just come out of a 5-day lockdown. You guys have just had a bunch of cases, or one or two cases announced overnight.
Yes, we have. Yeah, but our leadership in this state is how you would call inept. So they're not going to be locking shit down. Like, it's just not going to happen.
But I'm sure the West Australian government will be making an announcement sometime today, possibly about some change to border restrictions between each of the states.
Maybe.
Which basically makes touring in this country impossible.
Well, does it? So, I mean, when you think about it, most international bands that come to Australia, unless you're a big one like, you know, Metallica
I'm not talking about international bands. I'm talking about bands within this country. I mean, Voyager basically had to bin off their entire Australian tour because they didn't know what was going on with border restrictions.
They also had to bin off the other festival as well, which is happening up in Queensland, I think, like next weekend or the weekend after or something. So, you know, it's... I agree with you. But that being said, most tours happen on the East Coast. So long as those three states stay open, you probably get, you know, sort of 80%. You reach about 80% of the population with those three cities, right? So,
it's the getting into the country. I mean, you could just tell them you're playing tennis, and then they'll let you in, and you can sit in the hotel for 2 weeks and bitch about how you don't have a balcony, and then go on tour.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you could totally do that. You know, but of course they won't do that because it's not football. So, and this is now turning into a political.
This is the problem. It's like when we're talking about these sort of things, it's kind of hard not to steer away from politics.
Yeah,
and then
we've got our
next topic, which is Brexit, which is basically just 100% politics.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. It is. Look, it's very, very difficult. And you know what? We are going to be talking about a whole bunch of different things, obviously, over the course of this year. I mean, the Bird's Robe Collective thing was really, really interesting. I know Genesis have moved the start date of their tour to like September or something. And
yeah,
Northlane,
well, again, they've got. Well, I was going to say Genesis again. They've got the same problem. Phil Collins is currently based in America. The rest of the band are based in England.
Yeah.
Plus other backing musicians and other people involved in the thing. They're probably based in America, so they've got the same problem.
Fun fact, by the way, that I found out the other day. I don't know if you've seen. There's a show on Netflix called Emily in Paris.
No.
It's written by the guys who wrote Sex and the City and da da da. It's actually reasonably fun to watch. It's a good brain dead kind of thing to watch of an evening. If you're sort of very, very tired after a work day and or rehearsals and you just want to watch something in veg. There's a second season of it coming out. The main chick that's in it is Lily J. Collins, who is Phil Collins' daughter.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So I didn't. Oh, I yeah. actually didn't realize that until the other day. She put up something on Instagram, and it came up with a, "Oh, thanks for everything, Dad." And I was like, "Oh my god, it's a wow!" All right, so very interesting. What tangled webs people weave. And the other one as well is Northlane. Northlane have cancelled their European tours. Completely cancelled them. Not rescheduled. Not you know put them back or anything like that. But they've actually fully cancelled it. Good news, though, Full Tilt Festival, which is starting up, I believe, in Melbourne, is scheduled for a Brisbane run as well. Funnily enough, skipping over Sydney. Gee, I wonder why that would be.
Indeed.
So they're going to Brisbane, and it'll probably wind up being another big, big festival because we don't have a heavy music festival here in Australia anymore, which would be great. It'd be great to see us actually have a halfway decent bloody festival here that's got some decent names on it and so on and so forth.
Be interesting to see it go ahead. I mean,
but that's what I was about to say.
Yeah, with all these problems and little outbreaks and that sort of thing, it does kind of. But it's interesting. Like they managed to make it work for sports leagues. Why can't they make it work for music festivals?
Because they don't care about music festivals.
I mean, yeah, I know. And sport. Like this is the other thing as well. Why did they make it work for the sports leagues? Because then they could flog the thing to pay TV.
Yeah, exactly.
You put it on cable, you can make umpteen millions in ad revenue, people could bet on it. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, nobody, you can't bet on music. I'm sure someone will find a way, but
you
can't.
I could think of a million ways to bet on music.
What, you're betting on the set list?
Bet on the set list, bet on technical problems, you know, like...
A dollar and one on the keyboard's going down. You know?
Oh, exactly, yeah. but you know, I mean, I don't see why they couldn't do that anyway. I mean, I remember back with the Sound Relief Festival in 2009, that was broadcast over at the time, VMAX and so Channel V and, what was the other one? MTV.
Didn't the ABC have it?
No.
ABC have it as well?
No, they didn't. Triple J had an audio stream. But there wasn't any.
I remember watching bits. Maybe it was like a rebroadcast of it or something. Because I remember watching bits of that on TV.
Yeah, possibly. They possibly had like bits of it, but the actual full thing live was done by I think from memory, Channel V had Sydney, and MTV had the Melbourne show. So you could flick between the two or have them both on doing their thing. But you know, there's no reason why we couldn't do that again. You know, especially in today's day and age of streaming and all that kind of stuff. There's numerous ways around this kind of shit.
Yeah, I'm genuinely surprised nobody's tried like a pay-per-view kind of thing. I mean, everybody does like pay-per-view for UFC, boxing, etc.
Yeah.
Why can't you do pay-per-view for like a big concert on main event or something? Mm.
Well, there's a lot of people that are doing that with the cinema now. So you pay, you know, $30 or $25 or whatever it is for a cinema ticket these days and you go and watch Metallica for 2 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah, Rammstein did it years ago.
Yeah, there's always been like concert in 3D and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, look, what is interesting about all of this that's going on is that there is a lot of room there for innovation, right? There's a lot of room for solutions to these kinds of problems, which will end up permeating out. What I'm concerned about is the fact that not really any of it has taken off. And I think that's partly due to an old school thinking of, oh, well, you have to be there to experience it live and blah, 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 which is partly true, but people still buy DVDs anyway, right? So people buy DVDs and then they rewatch things and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, why you couldn't have a pro shot, thing with a live audience as well, albeit a small live audience, but have, you know, the 50 or 60 people in the room or whatever it is that you could have and have them doing their thing and then have that pro shot as well out to, you know, a live fan base and put it up on Veeps or one of these other streaming platforms. I mean, there's numerous ways around it, but people just aren't sort of embracing it.
That's part of the problem as well, but also as well, like who wants to take on that financial risk and be the first? Who wants to take that? Like you think about it, like the industry is decimated. There are many places you probably couldn't even like, you know, this is part of the problem with like the sports broadcasting. The reason why it took so long to get it off the ground is because in various places around the world, okay, here in Australia, we're blessed in that, you know, we basically don't have any COVID outbreaks and we can more or less live a relatively normal life. But over in other places in the world, like you can't shoot a live DVD thing and still enforce social distancing. You can in the crowd. You definitely can't amongst the crew members. Like, you still... Mm. This is the problem with, like... This is why they bubbled the idea of, like, bubble leagues with sports and stuff. They were like, we can't shoot anything because it physically requires us to be next to people and touching other stuff, which means it's damn near impossible to try and prevent an outbreak within the thing. And then you get into the next problem of having, like, people in the, like, you know, a crowd in the room and stuff like that, you know. It's just,
No, I mean... I agree with you on that. I mean, the problem would be if you had a seated gig, there'd be an easy way to do that. Just put one chair between everyone.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right? Seated theatre gig style sort of stuff. That's relatively, you sell less tickets. But here and there lies the next problem of, like, yeah, I saw this with, like, you know, Steve Hackett has had to reschedule his tour again. Mm-hmm. And someone said, oh, why don't we just, it's all theatre gigs. Why don't we just, like, have socially distanced gigs? And I'm like, dude, most of these gigs are sold out.
Yeah.
What are you going to do? Are you going to put everyone in a lottery and 50% of the people is like, you know, it's the worst lottery win ever. Congratulations, you've won the lottery. We're going to give you your money back and you can't come.
Well, I mean, there's that. And that, but I mean, they're also, and this is sort of going off topic a little slightly bit because that never happens on this show. Welcome to 2021, ladies and gentlemen. One of the things is as well, there needs to be some movement with the venue owners as well. I mean, we've seen this, right? You and I have seen how rigid, particularly in Sydney, venue owners are. There's a couple that are extremely good and they're quite malleable when it comes to, you know, numbers and all that kind of stuff. But there's quite a few that just say, nope, that's the amount, tough. There needs to be to let this industry get back on its feet, which, let's be really honest, at the moment, it's not even, it's at the part where it's got both its arms off and one foot and it's hopping on King Arthur trying to kill it. You know what I mean? Like, it's
okay. This is like the Monty Python. Come over here and I'll bite your arms off.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, that's the stage that the industry is at. And there needs to be some movement from venue owners as well to say, you know what? Cool. So instead of having one night at, you know, $1,000 a night or whatever it is, we're going to give you two nights at $1,000 and you can socially distance across the two.
Yeah, but Dave, you're forgetting the problem here. You're arguing against public health and safety. The venues are probably going to turn around and say, no, we can't accept that risk in case that this gig becomes like some sort of super spreader event. And then they get tagged like the Ruby Princess as like, oh, it was the venue that became like the super spreader.
Yeah, if you're arguing against
public health and safety, though, you're always going to lose.
But I don't think this is the thing. I don't think I'm arguing against public health and safety. The problem,
if you're talking about holding a music event in a venue, though, you are.
The problem you've got in Sydney is that there's like six venues. So
yeah, they're all and like four of them are owned by like one guy.
Exactly. So you don't have the ability, realistically, to hold an event less than 1,000 people. Right? The smallest room that is for hire in Sydney that's not a local venue is the Oxford Arts Theatre. Maybe Lazy Bones in Marrickville, maybe. But the OAF and Oxford Arts are reasonably on par.
Yeah, right. And you basically and to for them to break even, you basically need to fill the place, which that's at the moment you can't.
That's right. So that's why I'm saying
even at the best of times in a non-pandemic world, you still have struggles trying to fill the place.
Absolutely, because of how things are in Sydney. So I mean, the reality is, and that the sad reality of this is, the Sydney music scene is gone, and I've been saying this for years. It's dead. It's finished. It's all over. Like there is no reason nor rhyme to even try and give it fucking life support at this point. But what can come out of Sydney, and I firmly believe this, what can come out of Sydney is some innovation with technology to actually make Sydney the tech hub for the music industry. Genuinely, I believe that can happen. And you know what? You said who would have the financial risk to do, you know, these pro shot DVDs and all that sort of stuff. Fuck, I'll do it. Like, get a grant from the government, and there's plenty of people getting grants for fucking albums and all this sort of stuff, people we've never fucking heard of, right? So give me a grant.
Or even people that we have, like dear friend of the show, Joshua Patton, for example.
Exactly. Yeah, and you know what? Congratulations on that, Josh. I know you're going to make a fantastic, fantastic record with it. But there's a lot of stuff. I mean, I went through that list that he sent us. I'll back up and explain this for the listeners. There was a list that we got sent by Joshua Patton. About you know, who's got a whole bunch of music grants and so on and so forth from the government, etc. He was one of them. It's awesome.
We should probably specify here which government we're talking about here, because I don't think it was the feds. We're talking about the state Victorian government, aren't we?
The Victorian government did a whole bunch of funding grants for musicians and people in the music industry and the arts and so on and so forth. Joshua Patton, the unofficial third host of this show, got one of the grants to do a new album, and I'm really looking forward to hearing that. But there's a whole bunch of other people as well that got stuff in there. Wild Thing Presents, I think, got about $40,000 to put maybe a festival or something on. But you know, you never see that in New South Wales. It's just not going to happen. But I tell you what, give me $50,000 and I'll be more than happy to set up a mobile, you know, pro shot kind of thing. Throw a couple of DSLRs in there. I mean, the whole setup would probably cost you $25,000-$30,000, and you'd have a very, very pro end setup for doing that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? It would work extremely well. You could do it at smaller venues. You could then entertain social distancing at smaller venues, and you'd be all good.
Oh, well, put the grant together, Dave, and see what happens.
Yeah, exactly.
Probably have to move to Victoria first, because as you said, you'd never get this kind of money out of the New South Wales state government.
No, that's true. If you did, then there'd probably be some kind of a tax loophole or something you'd have to jump through.
Nah, you just got to be John Barilaro. Anyway, shall we move on?
I think we should. Yes.
Let's move on to another fun and popular topic, especially in this economy, Brexit.
Yay.
Now, obviously, there's been much talk and much discussion around the place about these EU musicians' passports that were, depending on who you listen to and depending on who you talk to, were either offered by the EU and knocked back by the British government, or offered by the British government, knocked back by the EU. Mm-hmm. I would be willing to bet good money down that it was the former rather than the latter, offered by the EU, knocked back by the UK.
Oh, absolutely. The EU have been more than forthcoming in this entire negotiations.
So in this, we're going to link to two posts. One of them is by Fish. He had made a Facebook post which listed many, many, many things that affect his specific business. And then we're going to link to a podcast episode where he went on and spoke at length about more issues and going into it in more detail, more than one can cover in a Facebook post.
I recommend sitting in with a cup of tea to read the post, because it's fucking long.
It is very long, but it does cover all the salient points that are required, like his mail order business, how he deals with like having his crew, because most of his crew also, like, basically road crew, they kind of work for everybody. So they just, you know, they do a bit with one tour and then they go off, oh, I'm going to be working with someone else. And so, like, these restrictions on UK personnel inside the EU basically mean they can't work at all. It's like he's got to work out, well, how long have you been in the EU for? Oh, you're only allowed in there for like 90 days or something. Oh, no, hang on, you can't do that, rah, rah, rah. Mm-hmm. Paying taxes, paying carnets, all that sort of thing. Like the mail order business, ordering records on the EU continent now from the UK now makes the records cost three times as much because of shipping and EU taxes.
Yep.
Because it was really easy, because he used to just pay, you know, based in the UK, he would pay taxes, and then now he's got to pay taxes to all the... It's just, oh my God, it's a fucking mess.
It is. It's an absolute mess.
And for what? Well, and the whole point, like we all know what Brexit was for, okay? I'm just going to lay it down on the line as an Australian who hasn't lived in the UK at all. But, like, Brexit, as far as I can work out, was founded on two principles. One, kicking out the immigrants. And two, like, multinational big corporate tax dodging.
Yeah, you're pretty much right.
Dodging around having to pay EU tax. That's it. Yeah, and they sold it along to the masses of like sovereignty and patriotism and all that sort of stuff. You know, the sort of sovereignty and patriotism that is like, you know, it has led them to like clapping for the NHS when they should really be standing with pitchforks at the front of the government saying, why the fuck aren't you funding the NHS more, you bloody ghouls?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. The same funding idea that would rather see a 100-year-old war veteran walking up and down his
doing 99 laps around his garden. Yeah.
Instead of them just funding it correctly. And he died, by the way, ironically, of COVID.
Yes.
Sadly.
Yes. Yes, unfortunately. And there was people saying, oh, we should clap for him as well. And it's like, but does anyone not see the ridiculousness of like a 100-year-old war veteran having to do laps around his garden to fund the NHS with all these rich fuckers who went to eat and aren't doing a damn thing about it?
That's right. That's right.
It's and just, once again, the arts and the musician community are the ones who get it in the neck.
That's right.
Every time.
That's right. There's a section here I want to read out from Fisher's Post, and that's what you were talking about, taxes here. It says, we pay tax in all the countries we pay in Europe. For example, in Germany, it's about 19% on the gross fee received from the promoter, and unless you're represented by a German-based company who can reclaim some of the costs, such as tour buses at around £1,400 a day, hotels for any day off at over £1,200 a night for the team, and various other production costs, which include a contribution to crew wages, the tax is taken off the top. When you pay those taxes, you receive a credit note from the respective tax authority, and that is provided to the HMRC to put against your UK taxes. It's called a reciprocal tax agreement. I paid over £25,000 in withholding tax in the EU on 2018 on one tour after allowances for costs because I had a German agent. Up until now, I have not had an answer as to whether or not that still applies. I'm supposed to be on tour in 8 months, and I don't even know if it's actually financially feasible. The contracts were signed in late 2019 and don't take into consideration any post-Brexit financial implications, as no one knew what they were until 2 weeks ago.
See, that is bananas.
Right? Now, I will say, as an Australian, welcome to our world, you know. I mean,
what, in terms of like paying tax?
Well, yeah, if we do anything like this over in Europe, it's the same thing. That's how it works for us, right? So,
yeah,
I mean, you know, welcome to our world. It doesn't make it right, but you know,
no,
tough,
especially considering like, but the thing is, but these whole bit, like, this is the thing. If the tax implications were the same for the UK as they are for us in Australia, the UK music industry would never have gotten to the heights that it did. Like, can you imagine if the Beatles had to pay as much tax as they did when they did their residency in Hamburg? They never got anywhere near as close as they would have. Because they would have gone bust and they wanted to go home. So it's like the whole business model has been predicated on, like, there's these arrangements with the EU where we pay, where we can apply for tax credits against the tax we pay in the EU to the UK, and then they move some money around and then it is financially viable.
Yes.
There's a reason why Australian bands don't tour Europe all that often. It's because it costs too bloody much to do.
That's right. And with the strength of the Australian dollar too, it doesn't help.
Yes, also, and then as well, like, you know, we can, like, I have seen people complain that it's like, oh, no one tours Eastern Europe. It's like, well, yes, because most of those places do not have the euro. Most, like, if you're playing those places, the currency rates are against you, so you may end up playing a show and having to pay most of that in tax. So, and then there's like the cost of like getting there and actually getting people to show up for a ticket because the wages are much lower. Anyway, it just becomes a giant mess.
It does, absolutely.
And now it gets even worse. It's like, I don't understand. Like, Anathema have basically announced they're going on a hiatus. I don't see a situation where Anathema are going to come back now.
No.
How can they?
They can't.
How can they?
They can't.
Like, it's like the situation is now stacked so heavily against UK musicians that unless you're fucking Roger Daltrey or Pete Townsend, you're never going to be able to afford to do it anymore.
That's right.
And here's the, like, the Brexit narrative was so dominated by dickheads with giant red buses that there was, like, I don't remember any musicians coming out and speaking out about this before the vote because the metrics and the conversation was so dominated around, like, business and big red buses.
Yeah, well, that and the fact that people in, and I've said this before, people in the UK, Australia, and arguably the United States, though the US is a little bit different, they don't see this as a job. They see it as a pastime that you have fun with.
Yeah.
Because you're not working in a factory.
And yeah, they don't. It's not. It's they don't see it as a large contributor to the economy and
no,
bringing in umpteen millions.
They don't.
Into the economy.
No.
And the secondary income that that generates from the hotels and the clubs and the pubs and the restaurants around the thing.
I remember sitting in a Liberal Party meeting once, and I'm not a member of the Liberal Party, by the way. I'm just going to put that out there. But I was sitting in a Liberal Party meeting once, and I had I asked the local member who I won't name. You know, why the government was doing this attack on the arts industry when it contributes X amount of billion to the economy every year. And he looked straight at me and he said, well, those numbers are disputed. And I said, no, they're not. It was by the report that you commissioned. It was a PwC report that you guys commissioned. Oh, yes, but, you know, it's not really that much and blah, blah, blah. But you commissioned the fucking report. What's the, you know... Like, I don't understand how you can say that it's not correct when it's your report. You guys, oh, yeah, but, you know, it's not as good. Anyway, look what we're doing at the hospital. Look what – it's just – it's fucking irrelevant because these people have no idea how much
– because the only thing they're thinking of is like, if we spend money at the hospitals and education and law and order are like three crowd pleasers.
Well, yeah,
we're doing something for the arts community and the general wider public go, fucking dirty hippies who don't vote, you know.
And
because the Liberal Party, like, this is the thing as well, the Conservative governments know that people who support the arts aren't going to fucking vote for them anyway.
Well,
unless it's like supporting the opera or something, you know.
The irony is that people are moving out of Sydney. We've had the second, I think, second year now of mass... exiting emigration from
Net emigration.
Yes.
Yeah, the national sport of Sydney is emigrating, yeah.
Yeah. So they're getting out of Sydney and they're going to Brisbane, Melbourne and Perth. Now, what are those three countries, those three towns have in common? Gee, could it be a vibrant arts community?
I was going to say a Labor government, but
that
sure,
too.
That works too.
But yes, so look... When it comes to Brexit and so on and so forth, obviously we encourage you to make up your own mind. But definitely check out what Fish has to say at length. We'll link to a podcast in the show notes below.
No, in terms of like making up your own mind though, but the trouble is the cake's already been baked. Like the deal's done. They're fucked. They can't, like, there's no control Z on this one.
Oh, absolutely.
The decision has been made, you know. The die has been cast. Hannibal's crossed the Alps. They're done. That's it. You know, the whole situation is now baked in. And unless they can somehow renegotiate an EU musician's passport to appease various people, like maybe, but I don't think so because it doesn't fucking matter because the Conservatives are going to win the next election anyway. That's the problem. The Conservatives, like the voting's, I'll come back to this and I'll keep banging on about it until I'm blue in the face. It's like the voting system is stacked in favour of, like the Conservative government won the last election with 37% of the vote. Like, when approval ratings are that low but re-election rates are that high, what can you do?
Exactly.
There's no way out here. Like, anyway.
Well, look, yes.
I think we're done yelling about politics now.
Yes.
Contrary to popular opinion, this is actually a music podcast. So maybe we should talk about some music, Dave.
I think we should. And kicking off the new music for the year to so far, Liquid Tension Experiment 3. First track off it, The Passage of Time. What do you think, out of curiosity?
Oh, I'm going to call it again. I think this is the safe one.
Mm-hmm.
Like... It's exactly what I mean. Liquid Tension Experiment haven't released an album in what, 15 years now?
Something like that.
2007. Yeah, something like that. 14, 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is exactly what I would expect from Liquid Tension Experiment.
Mm.
It's all of the major things. All the stuff is here. You got Tony Levin with your Chapman stick. You got the drum. It's all there. So I'm calling this the safe one. So I'd be very interested. I'm very interested to hear what the rest of the record has got on it. And what other sort of. If there's any other sort of technical wackiness going on that. Because, as I think we've discovered, it's like the Dream Theater and Dream Theater aligned projects always put the safe one out as the lead off single. Mm. What about you, Dave? What do you reckon?
I agree with you. It's a Liquid Tension Experiment song. You know, it's got everything there that LTE offers. Crazy, crazy music and cool stuff, and you know, it's always nice to see John and Mike working together again. You know, Tony Levin's a monster. Jordan Rudess is a monster. You know, it's fantastic to actually hear that and hear some of the old tones coming back and so on and so forth as well. I'm really looking forward to the album. I think it's going to be great.
I'd really like to know if they made it in a studio together in proper jam style, or whether it was like done in isolation in the studio, people flipping files back and forth.
I think that'd be very interesting to find out.
Because it certainly looks like the video was done sort of separately. Mm. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with that sort of... And can we talk about the video for a second? That is like a wacky ass, like sort of light show, psychedelica sort of thing going on in that thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an acid drop, that's for sure.
Totally.
You know, it's a great video. It does everything that it's supposed to do. It's a studio video at the end of the day with a few effects thrown over it. And it's great. It's fantastic. And it is a fantastic track. And I think the album's going to be awesome as well.
It certainly should be. Mm. I'm looking forward to it. When's it out?
I believe it's out on the 26th of March. So obviously we will be going track by track on that as soon as we can.
Totally.
And yeah, you're going to hear more about that one from us. Now, there's another band as well that they're actually from Australia, The Stranger. They've released a new video for their new single, 11th Hour. Did you check this one out, Hoggy?
I did have a listen to this one. Now, it's very much what I would have thought is Australian prog metal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a little bit of Caligula's Horse in there, there's a little bit of Chaos Divine in there, there's a little bit of Carnival in there. It's all good stuff. And I wouldn't say that this is necessarily derivative or sort of ripping off anybody else, but it's definitely got that Australian flavor to it.
Mm.
Yeah, very much of the Australian prog metal sound, I think. So,
Absolutely. And you know what? I mean, it was awesome that these guys, I think it was mastered by Jens Bogren.
Yeah, right.
And I mean, if you know who Jens Bogren is, I mean, he's worked with everyone, you know, from Opeth to Dimmu Borgir, Haken, Between the Buried and Me, Symphony X, Moonspell, Devin Townsend, Dark Tranquility, Paradise Lost, like...
So all the big bands of the prog metal scene.
Everyone, which is, you know, just amazing. I think he's worked with Catatonia, Sepultura, wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, right.
Like, it's pretty big, and it's awesome that obviously they've been able to get that done with him as well. So that's amazing, and it's great to see that, you know, there's Australian prog metal getting out there. This is very much the type of prog metal that I like, you know, clean vocals with a little bit of Cookie Monster in there. I quite like that. I'm not a huge fan of the stuff that's, you know, 90% Cookie Monster and then, you know, a little bit of clean every now and then.
Yeah, I think you need that. You need that mix, I think.
I agree. Yeah, I think it's a nicer mix. It means you can sing along at the show and, you know, you don't have to just sort of swing your arms widely in a hope to give someone a black eye.
Well, part of it as well is also like the artistic thing of like having just different, like sometimes it's one person doing it, sometimes it's two people doing it. You've got that sort of contrast between the light and the dark, I think, which when you're trying to tell a story can be quite handy.
Absolutely. I mean, Chaos Divine do that extremely well, because David's totally a monster.
That he is.
But check that one out. We'll put a link in the show notes below to their YouTube and probably to the Louder Sound article as well, where we first saw it. Now, you've got something in here.
And I was going to say, and their Bandcamp page as well, because the album is available to be bought like now.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We'll drop a link in the show notes below. Now, Hoggy, you've got something here. Richard Barberi, Under a Spell.
Yes.
What's this about?
He's got a record coming out in a couple of weeks' time through K-Scope Records, which I am very interested to hear.
Mm.
Big fan of Richard Barbieri's work, obviously. He of Porcupine Tree fame, he of Japan fame, worked with Steve Hogarth.
Mm-hmm.
Very well known in amongst the prog circles for his keyboard work. So he's putting a record out. I want to hear it.
Okay. All right. Where is it? It's through K-Scope, it says here. But has he got a Bandcamp and so on and so forth?
So Richard Barbieri does not have a Bandcamp page, but K-Scope does. So we'll put a link in the show notes to where you can pre-order this record. Now, As of this taping, there is nothing available to listen to. There is no lead-off single as yet. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure if there is, we'll be back to talk about it.
Absolutely.
So you've got something in here, Dave, about the new Soane record.
Yes.
Now, I actually had to listen to this record last night in preparation for this taping because I figured it was going to come up. Mm. Have you had a chance to listen to it? Oh, if so, what did you think?
Absolutely. This year, as I did last year, I am compiling all the new prog releases, and it did come up in note earlier, so I have listened to it. I really liked this album. They've taken a little bit of a break from – there's still a lot of Tool in there, but it's not as Tool-y as some of their older stuff. They've sort of molded into their own sort of sound now. I really liked it. I really enjoyed this album. Just go and listen to it. I like it. What did you think?
Yeah, again, like you said, there's a bit of Tool there, but it's not quite as Tool as the last one was, for example. Yeah. The last one I figured was just basically a straight-up Tool record with someone else singing it.
Exactly.
Where this one's a little bit less so. This one's a little bit more, I don't know, more in a different kind of direction rather than just straight-up Tool.
And I kind of like the track names as well. Lemurian, Deceiver, Monarch, Illusion, Antagonist, Modesty, Dissident, Fortune. You know, I kind of like those. They're not long titles, and that kind of tells a story in the actual the song names as well, kind of tell their own sort of story. Maybe they're about tarot cards or something, I'm not sure. You can tell I've been playing a lot of Cyberpunk because tarot cards come up quite a lot in that. But yeah, no, it's a good album. I really enjoyed it. And look, we know that there's been a whole heap of albums that have been released over the last, you know, couple of weeks that we've been off air. We're not going to probably get around to all of them, but we might review some of them and so on and so forth. So if you have got a favorite album that's been released recently, by all means, tell us, and we'll try and at least give it to each other for homework and talk about it a little bit. Providing it's Absolutely. Not the one that's the topic of our main topic today.
Yeah, I think we've kept the good people waiting long enough. Let's jump into our main topic, which I don't like. Originally, we weren't going to talk about this record because we were just kind of like, oh no. I think we both shat on the lead-off single "Personal Shopper" a little bit too hard. I think we'll get to that in a minute, but we are going to have a bit of a discussion around Stephen Wilson's new record, "The Future Bites," and I think we should just kick it straight off with like the most evil question of the lot, and like possibly the most irrelevant question. I don't know. We'll get to that in a minute. But like, is this really a prog album?
No.
Should we ever expect a prog album from Stephen Wilson again?
Expect, no.
No.
Hope for, yes.
Yeah, but you can hope and wish for a lot of things.
True.
Like, the thing is, like, is it a prog record? No. Ultimately, does it matter? No. Is it a good record? Yeah, I quite liked it.
It's a fantastic pop album. I can't take it off the guy, right? Stephen Wilson is a little bit like Kanye West, and I know that is going to get us some seriously angry emails, but before you start typing, just listen to what I'm about to say. Stephen Wilson is a little bit like Kanye West in that he's a bit of a knob, but he's an exceptional producer. The stuff that he does is very, very good. He's a very good musician. He knows what he's doing. You can't take any of that off.
Do you know what? I'd like to walk that back. I'd like to walk that back slightly. I don't think Stephen Wilson is necessarily the most technically gifted musician. He is, however, a fantastic songwriter.
He's a fantastic songwriter, but I think he's quite a good musician as well by virtue of the fact that he's been doing it for so long. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I was just talking about in terms of like technical abilities. Like for the longest time, he always had someone else play guitars for him, either John Wesley in Porcupine Tree, or then Guthrie Govan or Dave Kilminster or somebody else playing guitars for him.
I'm not necessarily saying
like, doing
that he's
that
a
technical,
right? He's not.
Yes, exactly. Doing all that technical stuff is kind of not his bag.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm looking at it more as a musician, as in the whole kit and caboodle of sitting down, and I'll bet you that Stephen can sit down, write some lyrics out, and then hear the song in his head, and he knows exactly how he wants it to go and so on and so forth. He would be one of those people who would have an idea in his head and do it, rather than, you know, sit down and write a riff and then write the lyrics around that and all that sort of stuff, like what I do. He's an extremely good conceptual musician from that point of view, and he's a very good producer. So, you know, the stuff that he touches generally sounds fantastic, it breathes quite well. And because of that, you know, you can migrate that from the prog sphere over to the pop sphere quite easily. You know, they're quite, it's quite good, and it's quite obvious with this album that that's, in my opinion, what he's done.
Yes, I agree. I agree. I mean, I personally have a problem with the whole 5.1 giant box set thing, but we'll get to that in a minute. Because I want to very briefly talk about, like, if you want to hear what we said about the lead-off single, because by God, we fucking shit on that a bit too hard in a previous episode. We'll put a link in the show notes to that if you fancy going back and listening to it. But I would be, I'm going to walk what I said there back, back in that episode slightly back, because I think, you know how we talk about the safe one, you know, with Liquid Tendency Experiment, Dream Theater, so they put out the safe one. Stephen Wilson, I believe, doesn't do that. I believe he puts out the wacky one.
Yes.
Like, of all the songs on this record that he could have put out as a single, he chose this one. It's the longest song on the record. It's the most sort of out there kind of thing that people would expect from him. For example, if he put out 12 Things I Forgot as the lead-off single, which kind of sounds like a Porcupine Tree song in a funny sort of way, if he put that out as the lead-off single, it'd be perfectly, like, it'd be, it wouldn't, probably wouldn't have generated, so, and it would just be like, oh yeah, another Stephen Wilson song. Because he put out the Personal Shopper record and Idiots Like Us completely got sucked in and started bagging it, you know, it's that old bit, don't read the press, just weigh it.
Yes, absolutely. And
we bought into it, hook, line, and sinker.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't necessarily think that that's a bad thing. I still think Personal Shopper was a shit song. I mean, it's got 1.8 million listens on streaming services and so on and so forth already. And I mean, this this album has a lot of total listens and so on and so forth as well.
I really think that, that the fact that that's the metric now is just, oh my God. Oh. Although it couldn't be any worse than the other metric. It made to like number two or number three on a chart. I don't know which one, and we all know what my position are on the charts are.
Exactly. It's the same thing. I mean, you can see it quite clearly when you see the plays lists for, you know, an entire album, and the average of all the songs is about 300,000 or something, and then you've got one that's like 2 million. It's like, well, obviously that's the single.
Yeah, but that was the lead-off single that was out for pretty much a whole ass year, and like basically
right.
6 months before this record came out.
Yes, correct. So
this
got
record
to take
was supposed to be out already, but then it got delayed, then it got delayed again, you know, these sort of things.
I mean, the... I'm not going to walk back what I said about the lead-off single. I still think it's shit. But, you know, it was it a clever marketing ploy? Probably.
Yeah. But I think then we need to get into, like, the next part of this, which is, like, why do the fans hate this record so much? Like, I was having a chat with some, friends of mine over dinner a couple of nights ago. And we were having this conversation. They're not necessarily superstar prog fans like I am, but they know enough about the prog thing. And and my buddy was like, why is everybody so pissed off? It's exactly what Stephen Wilson was going to do, something different. Like, all of the prog fans sitting around expecting him to make Fear of a Blank Planet Part 2 or In Absentia Part 3 or The Raven Part 2 or something are all going to be sorely disappointed.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to get that.
I mean,
you're not going to get that from him because he's done, he's like, oh, I've done that. Right, moving along.
I mean, we see that in the, in the Dream Theater camp, right, all the time. Everyone always running around going, oh, do Metropolis Part 3, you know.
Where could you pop, like, just as a quick aside from there, where the hell could you go with a Metropolis Part 3, honestly?
I don't know. To an 8th string.
Considering, like, Metropolis, hey. Like, what was that? Sorry?
To an 8th string. I don't know.
Yeah, but like the whole point, God damn it. Like Metropolis Part, it was a joke. It was a fucking joke to call it Part 1 in the first place. It was like a bit. And then they decided, and then they were like, oh shit, now we should probably write a Part 2.
And I mean, look, at the end of the day, what what did we expect from Stephen Wilson? I think the problem is, and this is, and I've spoken about this on the podcast before, when you have, when you are a particular artist and you're known for something in particular, great example of it is Linkin Park, right? Linkin Park's first, I'm going to say three albums because I include Reanimation in that, were sensational. They were brilliant. And then they brought out Minutes to Midnight, and that really signaled the turn for them into the pop side of things.
Yeah, because they kind of figured they'd done the nu metal thing to death already. Yeah. There's still bits of that on that record.
Yeah, I mean, not as much as you would like, you know.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they're fantastic live. I was fortunate enough to see them live a couple of times, once in the Meteora days, which I still hold very close to my heart. You know, but they progressed and they moved on with the times, and as a result, they pissed off their initial fan base, right? So their whole initial fan base, which were the red cap wearing, Fred Durst loving guys, got really annoyed, and then they brought a whole bunch of new people into the fold with that as well, and then there were people like myself who. I'm not a big fan of the new Linkin Park music. Do I appreciate it? Yes. Do I think it's just pop crap? Mostly, yes, also.
But, like, there's brilliant bands who've done that. Like, look at Muse.
Yes.
Muse started off doing interesting-sounding alternative metal.
Mm.
And then at a certain point, they abandoned all that and went into a more sort of electronica pop kind of thing.
Mm. And
some of that stuff is still pretty good.
I was about to say.
Some of it isn't.
Some of it's... brilliant. Some of the stuff, like the Second Law album, was actually a really, really good album, and translated quite well on stage too. Live, it was brilliant.
But that was part of the thing, in that a lot of the people who liked the old Muse stuff didn't like the new stuff, and thought they were, you know, going after the Twilight fans because, you know, they had their music featured in a Twilight movie, so they did a pivot towards people thinking that. Which is just, like, I doubt it was that calculated.
I doubt really it was that calculated as well. I mean, Paramore had the same thing with Decode, right? So,
yeah, exactly.
But it's what you've got then is ostensibly you've got a war between those people who run around going, I was listening to them before, blah, and then you've got the people who are going, well, I like them now, but I don't like their old stuff, right? And because there is such a divide there, it becomes problematic for the artist. And the artist is going, well, I just want to write music that I like. And it just so happens that at the moment I'm really into Americana. So that's going to take some influence on there. I've got a friend of mine here in Sydney, and his band that he was the lead singer of for quite some time, they were pretty heavy, rock heavy, you know, sort of metal influence, a little bit proggy, but mostly on the rock side of things. And then all of a sudden, one day they sort of broke up, and then he started writing some new stuff, and it was all Americana and sort of country based and such. And he contacted me and said, "Hey, do you want to play some guitars on us?" I said, "Sure." So we were working together and such, and I said, "This is completely different from your old band." And he's, "Oh well, yes, it is, because this is sort of what I want to write at the moment because I've been listening to a whole bunch of it." You know, and then there's other parts and other elements of it he was dragging from other stuff. It was some really cool stuff. It never went anywhere, but you know, it was very interesting music. And that's what you do as an artist. You grow as someone who you take influences as you go along. However, when you turn your back on the old fan base that basically got you where you are, you're going to get backlash.
Yeah, but herein lies the problem. In that, I've seen Stephen Wilson rip on certain sections of his fan base who are basically ridiculous prog rock snobs.
Mm.
But it's kind of hard to rip on those fans and refer and be really snobby towards snobby fans when you yourself have been on record multiple times about as a ridiculous pompous snob.
Mm.
Referring to Greta Van Fleet as a piss-poor third-rate Led Zeppelin band, for example.
Yeah, and I hope he's eating his words really, now because really their new single's fantastic.
I don't listen to Greta Van Fleet, but I'm sure I will at some point. But here's the thing, in that, like, when you've been really snob, when you've painted yourself as like an artiste and a snob towards the more modern consumerist things,
mm-hmm.
And then do, I mean, this I think is also part of it as well. It's like, he's no stranger to pop music.
Mm.
He's always done, like, I think we were talking about this beforehand. You were saying, oh, it's not a Stephen Wilson album.
Mm.
And I'm like, no, I think it is, because he's always done pop. It's always been under a different name, whether it be Blackfield or No Man, or even some of the Porcupine Tree stuff sort of sounds a bit poppy.
Mm.
Trains was a little bit in that sort of direction.
Mm-hmm.
Always Never, even on the first Porcupine Tree record, something like Nine Cats, for example, always had that little bit of a pop electronica sort of thing.
Even Lightbulb Sun.
Exactly.
You know, it has that almost an Oasis kind of vibe to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Which gets me to my next point.
Yeah, which gets me to my next point of like why I still think this is a Stephen Wilson record. It's like this is still got, it's still got his fingerprints in it, and by fingerprints I mean him ripping off other styles of music.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Like first, it started with him doing his take on psychedelica.
Mm-hmm.
Then it started with the prog rock. Then it went to the alt rock and the art rock. That's the In Absentia, Lightbulb Sun kind of era.
Mm-hmm.
Then he went with prog metal. That's when he teamed up with Mikhail Akerfeld and Robert Fripp and rah-rah and got Gavin Harrison to drum for him and started doing more prog metal stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Fear of a Blank Planet, Dead Wing, The Incident, which seems to be the era of Porcupine Tree that I think people like the most.
Funny
that. Was like when they were on that was when they were on Roadrunner, and that was when they had major record label support and rah-rah. And then he left, and then he went off and did more sort of prog rock kind of stuff.
Mm.
And then he got together with Mikhail Akerfeld, and then he did Storm Corrosion, which is basically ripping off Scott Walker and like post-metal.
Mm.
And now we've got him doing his sort of approximation of like David Bowie and Prince and ABBA.
Mm. Mm. I mean, so you're not wrong. You're not wrong. I mean, I suppose the question is, what does the listener identify with as, you know, Stephen Wilson? Is Stephen Wilson ripping off ABBA and Bowie and the Beatles and all that kind of stuff? Or is he ripping off, you know, the prog metal scene? You know, and for me, it's definitely the latter. That's what I identify Stephen Wilson as. You know, all that stuff, that Dead Wing, In Absentia. The Incident, yes, it's a great album. It's a great album. It's not my favorite of all of their stuff. I think for me as well, it's lyrically. You know, lyrically, he always had some amazing lyrics, great storytelling lyrics and all that kind of stuff. I don't get it from this album at all.
Yeah, this album does have a little bit more of the social commentary sort of thing, which unfortunately, especially like, which is why we shat on it pretty hard with like Personal Shopper, like his obvious cynical take towards consumerism rings very hollow when you spent a large portion of the last 15 years making yacht loads of cash out of like large box set edition records.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, bang on.
Like, and he's still doing them. Like, he's still involved in them as much as he doesn't like them.
Mm.
And it's like, bro, come on.
Yeah.
Like, I get it. Bro. Maybe his finances aren't that great, or maybe it's more of like a technical exercise rather than anything else or whatever. I don't know. But, you know, I mean, this is where I get, like all of that 5.1 box set stuff, I don't have any of it.
Mm.
I got the Marillion. Like, I have a couple of the Marillion ones, but that's solely for, like, the behind-the-scenes documentary stuff. I haven't listened to any of the 5.1 stuff.
Mm.
I don't even own a 5.1 setup.
Mm.
I don't have one. It's all stereo for me, and it's mostly original studio mixes. I don't much go for, like, the remixes where everything's clearer and more crystal. And I don't get it. I still don't and probably never will.
Mm.
Mm. Well, you know, that's just me. You know, I have many problems with the audiophile community because mostly I think they're deluding themselves into thinking it's better, or that they can hear a difference when they can't.
Well, in some cases, yes, in some cases, no. I mean, you can't,
yeah, but
you can't throw a $10,000 DAC into the same set of speakers and go, oh, it sounds better. It physically can't. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Like, and also as well, they set up these like ridiculous straw man tests where they like play Spotify against a fucking a really high definition remix, and it's like, oh, come on!
But that's like putting
a fucking a microwave burger from fucking Coles up against a filet mignon steak from Gordon Ramsay.
I mean, of course,
it's going to be different.
It's going to be different. But here's the really interesting thing, is that there actually have been tests done with that, And yes, original stuff from the 70s and so on and so forth, it sounds completely different because, I mean, the mixing technology back then was completely different. The way they did it was completely different. But if you put up a song that was released 2 weeks ago on vinyl versus MP3 versus FLAC, you can't tell a fucking difference. I don't care exactly what anybody says. Even like the 128 and all that sort of stuff, 128 versus 320 versus, you know, FLAC versus vinyl and all that, you cannot tell the difference. I don't care what anyone says. If anyone tells you otherwise, they are lying.
128, you can tell the difference. Like 128 and 320, this is what I'm saying. It's like the streaming bit rates that come out of Spotify is like 128 or something.
No,
because it has to be to get it. Is it?
Yeah.
You could definitely tell the 128, though. You can tell that the high end is something that there's a little bit less definition going on there.
You used to particularly easily be able to tell. Nowadays, it's a lot less because the compression algorithms have got a lot better. Mm.
But I will agree with you. The difference between 320 and FLAC and vinyl is nothing.
There's nothing. There's no difference.
There is no difference.
There is no difference. I don't care what anyone says. And, you know, these people that run around and they're, vinyl just sounds so much better. No, vinyl makes your pocket fucking lighter, you idiot. You know, it's just, yeah, anyway. And this is coming from someone who has a very large vinyl collection, you know, like,
yeah,
just, you know, it's not worth, you know, unless you're buying original copies and things like that for investment and for collection and such.
Yeah, but that's different. That's a different thing. If you're buying it because if you're buying the number one bloody White Album copy for £600,000 or whatever it went for, you're not playing that for the music. You're not buying that for the music.
Oh, fuck no.
Hell, every time you play it, you're probably losing a couple of hundred quid off the top.
Mm. Yeah, you're right.
Like, you're not buying that. That's a different thing.
Mm, mm.
You're not buying that for the music. You're buying that because it holds some arbitrary value in the economic system that we live in.
Mm, mm, mm.
That's a different thing than the music.
Mm, mm, absolutely. No, it's just, yeah, it is what it is. But
yeah, I mean, this is the thing. I mean, yeah, to sort of try and wrap it up a little bit in this sort of section where we have kind of rambled a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I still like the record, but, you know, moving it, like, Stephen Wilson is clearly moving off into a different direction. He's going away from the prog and more into the pop thing. Cool. He's more than welcome to do it, but, you know, and I dare say there will be a section of his fan base who are still going to follow along with it because they always do. I mean, this is what happened with a whole bunch of bands.
Mm. I think
Rush went from like prog rock to like synthesizers, and then they went to a more sort of hard rock, alternative rock kind of thing.
I think
people still followed along with it.
I think the reality is, and I go back to my Linkin Park example for this. This is a great album, but it's not a Stephen Wilson album for me. If this Stephen Wilson album had have been released under a different name, and it was like, you know, I don't know.
If this were a No Man record, I don't think we'd even be having this conversation. Just be like, oh, yeah, this is a pretty cool No Man record. Well, cool.
Exactly. And that's the thing. So you have a brand, right? And I don't think he's done his brand any justice by...
Yeah, but it's his name. It's Stephen Wilson. That's the whole point.
But
that's still
a brand.
That's why he got out from underneath. That's why he bloody split Porcupine Tree and went under his own name. Because he's like, nah, they're trying to pigeonhole me into doing different things. And he's like, nah, I don't want to do it. I want to do something else.
Mm-hmm. No, I understand.
Also,
that.
As well, he wants to call all the shots too. I mean, yeah, well, you know, yeah.
But I mean, look,
band leader with like superstar band as opposed to like band collective sort of thing.
Look, I appreciate that. I mean, I appreciate the fact that he wants to go out on his own, do his own thing, and all that kind of stuff. But I mean, yeah, I don't know. I'm nailing my colors to the mast. You know, I don't like this album at all. There are two songs I will single out, and that's 12 Things I Forgot and Follow Up. Because they're the ones notably with real instruments on them. And I say that as someone who's sitting next to two synthesizers and I have a whole bunch of doors and you know, VSTs and everything.
Real
like
instruments?
That.
Well, I'm sorry, when did you start working for Triple M?
No, I don't mean it in that way. And last week. No, I'm kidding. But I mean, you know, it's not just synthesizers and drum machines and all that kind of stuff, which is a thing that is going on in today's music, in today's musical world. You know, I love my synths. I love, you know, using them and so on and so forth. And my music that I'm writing at the moment with my band Proclivity, that has synthesizers and backings and choirs and all that kind of stuff in it. but it's not the main focus of the songs. Whereas this is very much the other way around, except for these two songs. You know, I mean, it is what it is. Personally, not a big fan of this album, particularly not with the amount of hype that it has come around. However, if musical journalism and music journalism has taught me anything, it is that the more divisive an album is, the better the album actually is. You saw the same thing with Daft Punk and Random Access Memories. It split the Daft Punk community in fucking two, right? And this album has done the same thing. Which basically means it's a great
album. I dare say it's been happening. The thing is with Stephen Wilson, though, it's been happening for a couple of records. Like, let's roll ourselves back to Hank and Audie Raise in 2014, that record came out. There was already a section of the Stephen Wilson fan base going, nah, this one's not for me. I'm done. I married one of them, so I know how this one goes. Like, when we roll forward to the next one, To the Bone, which is where I started to go, yeah, you know what? This is starting to move into a direction I'm not particularly interested in. And then we land at this one, and I think now the splitters, to borrow from Python, the splitters have fully made themselves very vocal, and they're like, no, this is a different thing. Yeah, we want the prog, you know, we were on the prog, you know, this is a prog thing, and we want the prog stuff. And it's like, well, no, he's not doing that anymore, so meh. So I think this is probably just the culmination of, I think, three records, because everybody loved the, like, all the prog people loved The Raven, because it was exactly what it was like. It was basically like 70s prog brought into the 21st century. You know, with the sounds and the things. And then Hank and I, there was still a bit of that on Hank and Audie Raise, but it started to move into a different direction. People were starting, I don't know. And then but the thing is as well, like with the wacky sync, like he did the same thing on the last record with Permanating. You know, he put that out as the lead off single, and the whole bloody prog community lost their fucking mind. They just was like, what is this? You know, this isn't what we want. And, you know, and with the video clip of him dancing around and, you know, people with their paint and whatnot, you know, it was definitely the shock value.
I agree.
And I bet good money he's gone, right, that worked last time, let's have another go with this one.
More than likely.
You know, what's the single that's going to piss the most people off? Aha, this one, bang, and it's got Elton John on it, even better, send it. So, yeah. That's about, like, it's a good album. It's definitely not a prog album. A lot of people are going to be very pissed off with it, but I still quite like it.
No, that's fair. That's totally fair.
Like, we'll move into the next part of it as well is, like, am I going to go and watch Stephen Wilson live if he comes to Australia? No, probably not. Like, nah, I'm done. Like, I don't think... Well, I don't think he's probably going to be touring on this record cycle anyway. I think he's going to have to get around making another one fairly quickly. But if he does tour it, I'm probably going to go and see him again. I think I'm done with that one. Yeah. Like, it's not what I'm interested in a live experience. Let's put it that way. I think that about wraps up that topic. What do you think, Dave? Unless you've got some more thoughts on that one?
No, I agree. I think that's about the end of it. I think we should move on to our album reviews.
So last time, Dave, I gave you an album by a band called Shaman Elephant, Wide Awake by Still Asleep. What did you think of this album?
Yes. Basically, what would have happened if the Doors had gone full prog after the death of Jim Morrison? definitely some really cool stuff on this album, including the track Steely Dan, which, for reasons of my love of Steely Dan, I love. Ease of Mind is another great one as well. Very different to the rest of the album. I really enjoyed it. Definitely worth a listen for anyone out there who's, you know, looking for some new music out there. It did come out last year, so it's definitely worth a listen to anyone. And if you've been listening to that big list of prog stuff, you've probably heard it anyway. So, but yeah,
there is a lot of great stuff coming out of Norway right now.
There really is.
I had a list of about, like, I think I said this in the last episode. It was like, I could put a top 10 list of stuff that just came out of Norway. Like, there's a lot of great stuff coming out of that country at the moment. And it's different stuff. It's not like people associate Norway and they think of like metal and black metal and death metal and all that sort of stuff. And it's like, nah, most of this stuff is in a different place now.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Probably influenced, but probably heavily influenced by those guys, but not, you know, stylistically sort of thing.
No, I agree. Now, I gave you an album by Majestic called Monument. What did you think?
Oh, dear Dave. This album was way, way, way too long.
Right?
Like, there are 6 songs on this record. The shortest song is 11 minutes and the longest one was 25 minutes long. It was an unbelievable slog to get through it.
It really was.
All meandering, very little in service of the lyric or the song or even a story. It's just an absolute bloat. I'm sorry, guys, if you're listening to this. I mean, like, prog in 2020 seems to have moved into a, you know, slightly shorter songs, still long concept kind of stuff. But just, oh, my God. Maybe this works better live with a light show and projections, but on the record, it's a deadly slog. And, like, this is their 9th studio record.
I know.
Which is, like, by now I would have thought they'd have figured it out, but apparently not.
Yeah. That's...
So, I really hate dumping on records like this because, like, they're really earnest. You can tell they're really talented musicians and they've got some great ideas, but, God, guys, you just got to cut some of that stuff
absolutely.
Down.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the reason I gave it to you, because we did do a lot of talking last year about, you know, is this in service of the song? Is this in service of the album, et cetera, et cetera? And this album, this particular album shows why it is so important to get that right. Because it was, you're right. I got halfway through this album. I was like, fuck me, is this over yet?
I had the same thing. I'm listening. I'm thinking, oh, okay, we must be halfway. I looked at it, I'm halfway through the second song.
Yeah.
And I said this to, well, I was listening to me with the zone. I said, do you know we're still halfway through the second song? And she's like, seriously?
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah.
Yep. Yep.
And it's like, oh my God. Like, you probably could have gotten away with half of that.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, yeah. We try to be positive about the music on this show. Yeah, we do yell a lot about politics, but, you know, the politics impinge the live experience of the music and the industry these days.
It does.
But when it comes to the music, we try to be positive, but this one, I just couldn't.
Yeah.
I just can't. I'm sorry. I really am.
I know. And it's a bit of a shame because it had such a cool album cover and I was really hoping that it was going to be great. And I saw the length of the tracks. So I was like, an hour and 40 minutes. Oh, that'll be really, holy shit, there's 6 tracks. How can that possibly be the case? You know what I mean? And... yeah, unfortunately.
But even if you
broke
it up a little bit and made like some, you know. But the thing is, there's nowhere to break it up.
Mm.
It's just one long run-on thing after another,
There's
like 10 minutes of instrumentals and then another verse of lyrics and another 10 minutes of instrumentals. Like, oh my God!
I know.
Just stop.
I know.
Stop, people. Like, you know, the new Transatlantic record came out. This week as well, which we haven't discussed really because, well, there's nothing really to discuss about the record because it's, I mean, you know exactly what you're going to get with Transatlantic. You're going to get, like, the overture sounded exactly the same as the last overture on the last 3 records that Neil Morse has put out. Like, at least it, like, that record was I listened to the extended version on Spotify. That was an hour and 30 long. And that was a bit of a slog, but not like this one.
Yeah. No, I agree with you.
Like,
I,
it was a little, it was shorter, it was split up, there was a little bit more different things going on, there was like some acoustic stuff, and I think the key part to this record as opposed to the Transatlantic record is on the Transatlantic record you had all 4 of them at some point or another singing on the record, so different people taking the lead.
Mm.
This had one person doing all the singing.
Yep.
There was no break. It was just the same thing. So I think with the Transatlantic one, because you've got different people singing different stuff, Peter Travis takes a lead, and then Reiner takes a lead. Even Mike Portnoy got a lead on this record.
Mm-hmm.
So mixing that up a bit kind of breaks it up a little bit. And it wasn't an hour. It wasn't like, I think the longest song on that record was 9 minutes. So it was shorter pieces kind of moving forward through the thing rather than just giant slabs of music in a 25-minute song.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to give this one a dirty, great big thumbs down.
Yep.
And I would, like... If you like that sort of thing, I mean, give it a listen, but I really don't think you can. I don't really think you should.
No, neither do I. Neither do I. So, all right, next week, Hoggy, or next fortnight, I should say, I've got another one for you by a band called Perfect Storm. The album is called No Air. Check that one out. That one's very, very recently been released, like a couple of weeks ago. So check that one out for me. What have you got for me?
So I also have a record that has been recently released, as in it's released in last week, I think. Mm-hmm. This is Steve Hackett's new record, Under a Mediterranean Sun. Ooh. Have a listen to that and okay. Tell me what you think.
Cool. I will check that one out and get report back to you and the good people who are listening to the show. So I think that about wraps it up for this episode of the 9-8 podcast.
Yes, it does. If you would like to find the show notes for this week's episode, you can find them at the98podcast.fireside.fm/68. You could find us on Twitter at 98FM. You could find us on Facebook at facebook.com/98FM. If you would like to, and you what you're hearing here has piqued your interest enough to want to help us with the show and get some extra bonus content, stuff that we don't release to the general public, you can consider supporting us on Patreon for $5 a month. You get a bonus episode, the little mini-sode that we release every time we put an episode out, and you get some bonus content and early access to any interviews that we do. You can find that at patreon.com/the98podcast.
Absolutely. And
feel free to drop us an email. You can find the contact form on our website at the98podcast.fireside.fm/contact.
Absolutely. Now, for the start of this year, we're actually releasing the first Patreon episode for free. So jump on over there and check that out. We're going to be talking about a little single that we released at the tail end of last year. We had a little bit of fun with the Beatles classic putting a new political twist on it. So we'll see you over there on our Patreon page. But until next time, my name is Dave Ellis.
My name is Alex Ogg. Thank you all very much. We'll see you next time.
See you then.